I can't do that, he said. He'll know I told you, and my freedom will be as short as my life.
It will be anyway when the clay finds out that you gave the mortal cup to Valentine, Clary pointed out. After tricking us into finding it for you, how can you live with yourself knowing what he plans to do with it? He cut her off with a short laugh.
I fear Valentine more than the clave, and so would you if you were wise, he said. He would have found the cup eventually, whether I helped him or not.
And you don't care that he's going to use it to kill children? A spasm crossed his face as he took a step forward. She saw something shine in his hand.
Does it all really matter to you this much?
I told you before, she said. I can't just walk away.
That's too bad, he said,
and she saw him raise his arm, and remembered suddenly Jace saying that Hodge's weapon had been the chakram, the flying disc. She ducked even before she saw the bright circle of metal spin singing toward her head. It passed, humming, inches from her face and embedded itself in the metal fire escape on her left. She looked up. Hodge was gazing at her, the second metal disc held lightly in his right hand.
You can still run, he said.
Instinctively, she raised her hands, though logic told her the chakram would just slice them into pieces. Hodge! Something hurtled in front of her, something big, gray-black, and alive. She heard Hodge shout in horror. Stumbling backward, Clary saw the thing more clearly as it paced between her and Hodge. It was a wolf, 6 feet in length, with a jet-black coat shot through with a single stripe of gray. Hodge, the metal disc gripped in his hand, was white as a bone.
You,
he breathed. And with a sense of distant astonishment, Clary realized he was talking to the wolf.
I thought that you had fled.
The wolf's lips drew back from its teeth, and she saw its lolling red tongue. There was hatred in its eyes as it looked at Hodge, a pure and human hatred.
Did you come for me or for the girl? Said Hodge.
Sweat streamed from his temples, but his hand was steady. The wolf paced toward him, growling low in its throat.
There's still time, said Hodge. Valentine would take you back.
With a howl, the wolf sprang. Hodge cried out again. Then there was a flash of silver and a sickening noise as the chakram embedded itself in the wolf's side. The wolf reared back on its hind legs, and Clary saw the disc's edge jutting from the wolf's fur, blood streaming just as it struck Hodge. Hodge screamed once as he went down, the wolf's jaws clamping shut over his shoulder. Blood flew into the air like the spray of paint from a broken can, splattering the cement wall with red. The wolf lifted its head from the tutor's limp body and turned its gray, lupine gaze on Clary, teeth dripping scarlet. She didn't scream. There was no air in her lungs that she could have dragged up to make a sound. She scrambled to her feet and ran, for the mouth of the alley and the familiar neon lights of the street. Ran for the safety of the real world. She could hear the wolf growling behind her, feel its hot breath on the bare backs of her legs. She put on one last burst of speed, flinging herself toward the street. The wolf's jaws closed on her leg, jerking her backward. Just before her head struck the hard pavement, plunging her into blackness, she discovered that she did have enough air to scream after all. The sound of dripping water woke her. Slowly, Clary peeled her eyes open. There wasn't much to see. She lay on a wide cot that had been placed on the floor of a small, dingy-walled room. There was a rickety table propped against one wall. On it was a cheap-looking brass candle holder sporting a fat red candle that cast the only light in the room. The ceiling was cracked and damp, wetness seeping down through the fissures in the stone. Clary felt a vague sense that something was missing from the room, but this concern was overwhelmed by the strong smell of wet dog. She sat up and immediately wished she hadn't. Hot pain drove through her head like a spike, followed by a racking wave of nausea. If there had been anything in her stomach, she would have thrown it up. A mirror hung over the cot, dangling from a nail driven between two stones. She glanced in it and was appalled. No wonder her face hurt. Long, parallel scratches ran from the corner of her right eye down to the edge of her mouth. Her right cheek was crusted with blood, and blood was smeared on her neck and all down the front of her shirt and jacket. In a sudden panic, she grabbed for her pocket, then relaxed. The stele was still there. It was then that she realized what was odd about the room. One wall of it was bars. Thick, iron, floor-to-ceiling bars. She was in a jail cell. Veins surging with adrenaline, Clary staggered to her feet. A wave of dizziness washed over her, and she caught at the table to steady herself. "I will not faint," she told herself grimly. Then she heard the footsteps. Someone was coming down the hallway outside the cell. Clary backed up against the table. It was a man. He was carrying a lamp, its light brighter than the candle, which made her blink and turned him into a backlit shadow. She saw height, square shoulders, ragged hair. It was only when he pushed the door of the cell open and came inside that she realized who he was. He looked the same. Worn jeans, denim shirt, work boots, same uneven hair, same glasses pushed down to the bridge of his nose. The scars she'd noticed along the side of his throat last time she'd seen him were healing patches of shiny skin now. Luke. It was all too much for Clary. Exhaustion, lack of sleep and food, terror and bloodlust caught up with her in a rushing wave. She felt her knees buckle as she slid toward the ground. In seconds, Luke was across the room. He moved so fast, she didn't have time to hit the floor before he caught her, swinging her up the way he'd done when she was a little girl. He set her down on the cot and stepped back, eyes anxious. "Clary," he said, reaching for her. "Are you all right?" She flinched away, throwing up her hands to ward him off. "Don't touch me." An expression of profound hurt crossed his face. Wearily, he drew a hand across his forehead. "I guess I deserve that." "Yeah, you do." The look on his face was troubled. "I don't expect you to trust me." "That's good, because I don't." "Clary." He began to pace the length of the cell. "What I did, I don't expect you to understand. I know you feel that I abandoned you."
"You did abandon me," she said. "You told me never to call you again. You never cared about me. You never cared about my mother. You lied about everything."
"Not," he said, "about everything."
"So your name really is Luke Garraway?"
His shoulders drooped perceptibly. "No," he said, then glanced down. A dark red patch was spreading across the front of his blue denim shirt. Clary sat up straight.
"Is that blood?" she demanded.
She forgot for a moment to be furious. "Yes," said Luke, his hand against his side. "The wound must have torn open when I lifted you."
"What wound?"
Clary couldn't help asking. He said with deliberation, "Hodge's discs are still sharp, though his throwing arm is not what it once was. I think you may have nicked a rib."
"Hodge," Clary said. "When did you..."
He looked at her, not saying anything, and she remembered suddenly the wolf in the alley, all black except for that one gray streak down its side, and she remembered the disc hitting it, and she realized.
"You're a werewolf."
He took his hand away from his shirt. His fingers were stained red. "Yep," he said laconically. He moved to the wall and rapped sharply on it, once, twice, three times. Then he turned back to her. "I am."
"You killed Hodge," she said, remembering.
"No." He shook his head. "I hurt him pretty badly, I think, but when I went back for the body, it was gone. He must have dragged himself away."
"You tore at his shoulder," she said. "I saw you."
"Yes. Though it's worth noting that he was trying to kill you at the time. Did he hurt anyone else?" Clary sank her teeth into her lip. She tasted blood, but it was old blood from where Hugo had attacked her.
"Jace," she said in a whisper. "Hodge knocked him out and handed him over to Valentine."
"To Valentine?" Luke said, looking astonished.
I knew Hodge had given Valentine the mortal cup, but I hadn't realized.
How did you know that? Clary began before remembering.
You heard me talking to Hodge in the alley, she said,
before you jumped him.
I jumped him, as you put it, because he was about to slice your head off, Luke said, then looked up as the cell door opened again and a tall man came in, followed by a tiny woman, so short she looked like a child. Both of them wore plain casual clothes, jeans and cotton shirts, and both had the same untidy flyaway hair, though the woman's was fair and the man's was a badgery gray and black. Both had the same young-old faces, unlined but with tired eyes.
Clary, said Luke, meet my second and third, Gretel and Alaric.
Alaric inclined his massive head to her.
We have met.
Clary stared, alarmed.
Have we?
At the Hotel du Mort, he said. You put your knife in my ribs.
She shrank against the wall.
I'm sorry.
Don't be, he said. It was an excellent throw.
He slid a hand into his breast pocket and removed Jace's dagger, with its winking red eye. He held it out to her.
I think this is yours.
Clary stared.
But don't worry, he assured her. I cleaned the blade.
Wordlessly, she took it. Luke was chuckling under his breath.
In retrospect, he said, perhaps the raid on the Du Mort was not as well planned as it might have been. I had set a group of my wolves to watch you and go after you if you seemed to be in any danger. When you went into the Du Mort, Jace and I could have handled it.
Clary slid the dagger into her belt. Gretel aimed a tolerant smile at her.
Is that what you summoned us for, sir?
No, said Luke. He touched his side. My wounds opened up, and Clary here has some injuries of her own that could use a bit of tending, if you wouldn't mind getting the supplies. Gretel inclined her head.
I will return with the healing kit, she said and left, Alaric trailing her like an outsized shadow.
She called you sir, said Clary the moment the cell door closed behind them. And what do you mean by your second and third? Second and third what?
In command, said Luke slowly. I am the leader of this particular wolf pack. That's why Gretel called me sir. Believe me, it took a fair bit of work to break her of the habit of calling me master.
Did my mother know?
Know what?
That you're a werewolf.
Yes, she's known since it happened.
Neither of you, of course, thought to mention this to me.
I would have told you, said Luke, but your mother was adamant that you know nothing of shadow hunters or the shadow world. I couldn't explain away my being a werewolf as some kind of isolated incident, Clary. It's all part of the larger pattern that your mother didn't want you to see. I don't know what you've learned.
A lot, Clary said flatly. I know my mother was a shadow hunter. I know she was married to Valentine and that she stole the mortal cup from him and went into hiding. I know that after she had me, she took me to Magnus Bane every 2 years to have my sight taken away. I know that when Valentine tried to get you to tell him where the cup was in exchange for my mom's life, you told him she didn't matter to you.
Luke stared at the wall.
I didn't know where the cup was, he said. She'd never told me.
You could have tried to bargain. Valentine doesn't bargain. He never has. If the advantage isn't his, he won't even come to the table. He's entirely single-minded and totally without compassion, and though he may have loved your mother once, he wouldn't hesitate to kill her. No, I wasn't going to bargain with Valentine.
So you just decided to abandon her? Clary demanded furiously. You're the leader of a whole pack of werewolves, and you just decided she didn't even really need your help? You know, it was bad enough when I thought you were another shadow hunter and you turned your back on her because of some stupid shadow hunter vow or something. But now I know you're just a slimy downworlder who didn't even care that all those years she treated you like a friend, like an equal, and this is how you paid her back.
Listen to you, Luke said quietly. You sound like a Lightwood. She narrowed her eyes.
Don't talk about Alec and Isabel like you know them.
I meant their parents, said Luke, whom I did know, Very well, in fact, when we were all shadow hunters together. She felt her lips part in surprise. I knew you were in the circle, but how did you keep them from finding out you were a werewolf? Didn't they know?
No, said Luke, because I wasn't born a werewolf. I was made one. And I can already see that if you're going to be persuaded to listen to anything I have to say, you're going to have to hear the whole story. It's a long tale, but I think we have the time for it.
Part 3. The Descent Beckons. The descent beckons as the ascent beckoned. William Carlos Williams, The Descent. 21. The Werewolf's Tale. The truth is, I've known your mother since we were children. We grew up in Idris. It's a beautiful place, and I've always regretted that you've never seen it. You would love the glossy pines in winter, the dark earth and cold crystal rivers. There's a small network of towns and a single city, Alicante, where the Clave meets. They call it the Glass City because its towers are shaped from the same demon-repelling substance as our steles. In the sunlight, they sparkle like glass. When Jocelyn and I were old enough, we were sent to Alicante to school. It was there I met Valentine. He was older than I was by a year, by far the most popular boy in school. He was handsome, clever, rich, dedicated, an incredible warrior. I was nothing. Neither rich nor brilliant, from an unremarkable country family, and I struggled in my studies. Jocelyn was a natural shadow hunter. I was not. I could not bear the lightest marks or learn the simplest techniques. I thought sometimes about running away, returning home in shame, even becoming a mundane. I was that miserable. It was Valentine who saved me. He came to my room. I'd never even thought he knew my name. He offered to train me. He said he knew that I was struggling, but he saw in me the seeds of a great shadow hunter. And under his tutelage, I did improve. I passed my exams, bore my first marks, killed my first demon. I worshipped him. I thought the sun rose and set on Valentine Morgenstern. I wasn't the only misfit he'd rescued, of course. There were others. Hodge Starkweather, who got along better with books than he did with people. Maris Trueblood, whose brother had married a mundane, Robert Lightwood, who was terrified of the marks. Valentine brought them all under his wing. I thought it was kindness then. Now I am not so sure. Now I think he was building himself a cult. Valentine was obsessed with the idea that in every generation there were fewer and fewer shadow hunters, that we were a dying breed. He was sure that if only the Clave would more freely use Raziel's cup, more shadow hunters could be made. To the teachers, this idea was sacrilege. It is not for just anyone to choose who can and cannot become a shadow hunter. Flippantly, Valentine would ask, why not make all men shadow hunters then? Why not gift them all with the ability to see the shadow world? Why keep that power selfishly to ourselves? When the teachers answered that most humans cannot survive the transition, Valentine claimed they were lying, trying to keep the power of the Nephilim limited to an elite few. That was his claim at the time. Now I think he probably felt the collateral damage was worth the end result. In any case, he convinced our little group of his rightness. We formed the circle, with our stated intent being to save the race of shadow hunters from extinction. Of course, being 17, we weren't quite sure how we would do it, but we were sure we'd eventually accomplish something significant. Then came the night that Valentine's father was killed in a routine raid on a werewolf encampment. When Valentine returned to school after the funeral, he wore the red marks of mourning. He was different in other ways. His kindness was now interspersed with flashes of rage that bordered on cruelty. I put this new behavior down to grief and tried harder than ever to please him. I never answered his anger with anger of my own. I felt only the sixth sense that I disappointed him. The only one that could calm his rages was your mother. She had always stood a little apart from our group, sometimes mockingly calling us Valentine's fan club. That changed when his father died. His pain awakened her sympathy. they fell in love.
I loved him too. He was my closest friend, and I was happy to see Jocelyn with him. When we left school, they married and went to live on her family's estate. I also returned home, but the circle continued. It had started as a sort of school adventure, but it grew in scale and power, and Valentine grew with it. Its ideals had changed as well. The circle still clamored for the mortal cup, but since the death of his father, Valentine had become an outspoken proponent of war against all downworlders, not just those who broke the accords. This world was for humans, he argued, not part demons. Demons could never be fully trusted. I was uncomfortable with the circle's new direction, but I stuck with it, partly because I still couldn't bear to let Valentine down, partly because Jocelyn had asked me to continue. She had some hope that I would be able to bring moderation to the circle, but that was impossible. There was no moderating Valentine, and Robert and Maris Lightwood, now married, were almost as bad. Only Michael Wayland was unsure, as I was, but despite our reluctance, we followed still. As a group, we hunted downworlders tirelessly, seeking those who had committed even the slightest infraction. Valentine never killed a creature who had not broken the accords, but he did other things. I saw him fasten silver coins to the eyelids of a werewolf child, blinding her, in an attempt to get the girl to tell him where her brother was. I saw him... But you don't need to hear this. No. I'm sorry. What happened next was that Jocelyn became pregnant. The day she told me that, she also confessed that she had grown afraid of her husband. His behavior had turned weird, erratic. He would disappear into their cellars for nights at a time. Sometimes she would hear screams through the walls. I went to him. He laughed, dismissing her fears as the jitters of a woman carrying her first child. He invited me to hunt with him that night. We were still trying to clean out the nest of werewolves who had killed his father years before. We were parabatai, a perfect hunting team of two, warriors who would die for each other. So when Valentine told me he would guard my back that night, I believed him. I didn't see the wolf until it was on me. I remember its teeth fastened on my shoulder and nothing else of that night. When I awoke, I was lying in Valentine's house, my shoulder bandaged, and Jocelyn was there. Not all werewolf bites result in lycanthropy. I healed of the injury and passed the next few weeks in a torment of waiting. Waiting for the full moon. The Clave would have locked me in an observation cell had they known, but Valentine and Jocelyn kept silent. 3 weeks later, the moon rose full and bright, and I began to change. The first change is always the hardest. I remember a bewilderment of agony, a blackness, and waking up hours later in a meadow miles from a city. I was covered in blood, the torn body of some small woodland animal at my feet. I made my way back to the manor, and they met me at the door. Jocelyn fell on me weeping, but Valentine pulled her away. I stood bloody and shaking on my feet. I could scarcely think, and the taste of raw meat was still in my mouth. I don't know what I had expected, but I suppose I should have known. Valentine dragged me down the steps and into the woods with him. He told me that he ought to kill me himself, but seeing me then, he could not bring himself to do it. He gave me a dagger that had once belonged to his father. He said I should do the honorable thing and end my own life. He kissed the dagger when he handed it to me and went back inside the manor house and barred the door. I ran through the night, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a wolf, until I crossed the border. I burst into the midst of the werewolf encampment, brandishing my dagger, and demanded to meet in combat the lycanthrope who'd bitten me and turned me into one of them. Laughing, they pointed me toward the clan leader. Hands and teeth still bloody from the hunt, he rose to face me. I'd never been much for a single combat. The crossbow was my weapon. I had excellent sight and aim. But I had never been very good at close range. It was Valentine who was skilled in fighting hand to hand. But I wanted only to die and to take with me the creature who had ruined me. I suppose I thought if I could avenge myself and kill the wolves who had murdered his father, Valentine would mourn me.
as we grappled, sometimes as men, sometimes as wolves, I saw that he was surprised by my fierceness. As the night faded into day, he began to tire, but my rage never abated. And as the sun began to set again, I sank my dagger into his neck and he died, soaking me with his blood. I expected the pack to set on me and tear me apart, but they knelt at my feet and bared their throats in submission. The wolves have a law. Whoever kills the clan leader takes his place. I had come to the place of the wolves, and instead of finding death and vengeance there, I found a new life. I left behind my old self and almost forgot what it was like to be a shadow hunter. But I did not forget Jocelyn. The thought of her was a constant companion. I feared for her in the company of Valentine, but I knew that if I came near the manor house, the circle would hunt me down and kill me. In the end, she came to me. I was asleep in the camp when my second-in-command came to tell me that there was a young shadow hunter woman waiting to see me. I knew immediately who it must be. I could see the disapproval in his eyes as I raced to meet her. They all knew I had once been a shadow hunter, of course, but it was considered a shameful secret never spoken of. Valentine would have laughed. She was waiting for me just outside the encampment. She was no longer pregnant and looked drawn and pale. She had had her child, she said, a boy, and had named him Jonathan Christopher. She cried when she saw me. She was angry that I had not let her know I was still alive. Valentine had told the circle I had taken my own life, but she had not believed it. She knew that I would never do such a thing. I felt her faith in me was unwarranted, but I was so relieved to see her again that I didn't contradict her. I asked her how she had found me. She said that there were rumors in Alicante of a werewolf who had once been a shadow hunter. Valentine had heard the rumors too, and she had ridden to warn me. He came soon after, but I hid from him, as werewolves can, and he left without bloodshed. After that, I began to meet Jocelyn in secret. It was the year of the Accords, and all of Downworld was abuzz with them and Valentine's probable plans for disrupting them. I heard that he had argued passionately in the Clave against the Accords, but with no success. So the Circle made a new plan, steeped in secrecy. They allied themselves with demons, the greatest enemies of shadow hunters, in order to procure weapons that could be smuggled undetected into the Great Hall of the Angel, where the Accords would be signed. And with the aid of a demon, Valentine stole the mortal cup. He left in its place a facsimile. It was months before the Clave realized the cup was missing, and by then it was too late. Jocelyn tried to learn what Valentine intended to do with the cup, but could not. But she knew that the Circle planned to fall upon the unarmed Downworlders and murder them in the hall. After such wholesale slaughter, the Accords would fail. Despite the chaos, in a strange way, those were happy days. Jocelyn and I sent messages covertly to the fairies, the warlocks, and even to those age-old enemies of wolfkind, the vampires, warning them of Valentine's plans and bidding them prepare for battle. We worked together, werewolf and Nephilim. On the day of the Accords, I watched from a hidden place as Jocelyn and Valentine left the manor house. I remember how she bent to kiss the white blonde head of her son. I remember the way the sun shone on her hair. I remember her smile. They rode into Alicante by carriage. I followed, running on 4 feet, and my pack ran with me. The Great Hall of the Angel was crowded with all the assembled Clave and score upon score of Downworlders. When the Accords were presented for signing, Valentine rose to his feet and the Circle rose with him, sweeping back their cloaks to lift their weapons. As the hall exploded into chaos, Jocelyn ran to the great double doors of the hall and flung them open. My pack were the first at the door. We burst into the hall, tearing the night with our howls, and we were followed by fairy knights with weapons of glass and twisted thorns. After them came the night children, with bared fangs and warlocks wielding flame and iron. As the panicked masses fled the hall, we fell upon the members of the Circle. Never had the Hall of the Angel seen such bloodshed. We tried not to harm those shadow hunters who were not of the Circle. Jocelyn marked them out, one by one, with a warlock spell. But many died, and I fear we were responsible for some. Certainly, afterward, we were blamed for many. As for the circle, there were far more of them than we had imagined.